said,
"I beg you, do not call me by that name, cousin."
She laughed.
"So, even though you live among Christians, you have the old belief of the fairy folk, that one who knows your true name can command your spirit if he will. You know my name, cousin. What would you have me call you? Lance, then?"
"What you will, save for the name my mother gave me. I still fear her voice when she speaks that name in a certain tone. I seem to have drunk in that fear from her breasts."
She reached over to him and laid her fingertip over the spot between his brows, which was sensitive to the sight. She breathed softly on it and heard his gasp of astonishment, for the ringstones above them seemed to melt away into shadows. Before them now, the whole top of the tor stretched, with a little wattle and daub church rising beneath a low stone tower which bore a crude painting of an angel. Lancelot crossed himself swiftly as a line of grey-clad forms came toward them, as it seemed.
"Can they see us, Morgaine?"
His voice was a rough whisper. "Some of them, perhaps, can see us as shadows.
A few may think we are some of their own people, or that their eyes are dazzled with the sun, and they see what is not there," she said, with a catch of breath. For what she told him was a mystery which she really should not have spoken to an uninitiated person.
But she had never in her life felt so close to anyone. She felt she couldn't bear it to keep secrets from him, and made him this gift, telling herself that the lady wanted him for Avalon. What a Merlin he would make! She could hear the soft sound of singing. "O thou Lamb of God, who drawest away from us all evil of this world, Lord Christ, show us thy mercy." He was singing it softly under his breath as the church vanished and the ringstones towered again above them. She said quietly, "Please, it is an offence to the great goddess to sing that here. The world she has made is not evil, and no priestess of hers will allow man to call it so."
"As you will."
He was silent, and again the shadow of cloud passed over his face. His voice was musical, so sweet that when he ceased singing, she longed to hear it again. "Do you play the harp, Lance? Your voice is beautiful enough for a bard."
"As a child I was taught. After, I had only the usual training befitting a nobleman's son," said Lancelot.
"I learned only so great a love of music as to be discontented with my own sounds."
"Is it so? A druid in training must be a bard before he is a priest, for music is one of the keys to the laws of the universe."
Lancelot sighed. "A temptation, that. One of the few reasons I can see for embracing that vocation. But my mother would have me sit in Avalon and play the harp while the world falls apart around us, and the Saxons and the wild Northmen burn and ravage and pillage. Have you ever seen a village sacked by the Saxons, Morgaine?"
Quickly he answered his own question.
"No, you have not. You are sheltered here in Avalon, outside of the world where these things are happening, but I must think of them. I am a soldier, and it seems to me that in these times defending this beautiful land against their burning and looting is the only work befitting a man."
His face was indrawn, looking on dreadful things. "If war is so evil," Morgaine said,
"why not shelter from it here?
So many of the old druids died in that last of great magics which removed this holy place from profanation, and we have not enough sons to train in their place." He sighed.
"Avalon is beautiful, and if I could make all kingdoms as peaceful as Avalon, then I would gladly stay here forever, and spend my days in harping and making music, and speaking with the spirits of the great trees. But it seems to me no work for a man to skulk here in safety when others outside must suffer. Morgaine, let us not speak of it now. For today, I beg you, let me forget. The world outside is filled with strife, and I came here for a day or two of peace. Will you not give it to me? His voice, musical and deep, trembled a little, and the pain in it hurt her so profoundly she thought for a moment that she would weep. She reached for his hand and pressed it. Come, she said. You wanted to see if the view was as you remembered. She led him from the ring stones, and they looked out over the lake. Bright water, rippling softly in the sunlight, stretched all around the island. Far below, a little boat, no larger at this height than a fish leaping, streaked the surface. Other islands, indistinct in the mist, rose as dim shapes, blurred by distance, and by the magical veil which removed Avalon from the world. "Not very far from here," he said. "There's an old fairy fort at the top of a hill, and the view from the wall is such that standing there a man can see the Tor and the lake. And there is an island which is like the shape of a coiled dragon." He gestured with his shapely hand. "I know the place," Morgaine said. "It is on one of the old magical lines of power which crisscross the earth. I was brought there once to feel the earth powers there. The fairy people knew those things. I can sense them a little, feel the earth and the air tingling. Can you feel it? You too are of that blood, being Vivian's son." He said in a low voice, "It is easy to feel the earth and air tingling with power, here in this magical isle." He turned away from the view, saying as he yawned and stretched, "That climb must have taxed me more than I thought, and I rode much of the night. I'm ready to sit in the sun and eat some of that bread you carried here for us." Morgaine led him into the very centre of the ring stones. If he was sensitive at all, she thought, he would be aware of the immense power here. "Lie back on the earth, and she will fill you with her strength," she said, and handed him a piece of the bread, which she had spread thickly with butter and comb honey before wrapping it in a bit of deerskin. They ate slowly, licking their fingers free of the honey, and he reached for her hand, taking it up playfully and sucking a bit of honey off her finger. "How sweet you are, cousin," he said, laughing, and she felt her whole body alive with the touch. She picked up his hand to return the gesture, and suddenly dropped it as if it had burned her. To him it was only a game, perhaps, but it could never be so to her. She turned away, hiding her burning face in the grass. Power from the earth seemed to flow up through her, filling her with the strength of the very goddess herself. "You are a child of the goddess," she said at last. "Do you know nothing of her mysteries?"
"Very little, though my father once told me how I was begotten, a child of the great marriage between the king and the land. And so, I suppose, he thought I should be loyal to the very land of Brittany, which is mother and father to me.
I have been at the great centre of the old mysteries, the great avenue of stones at Karnak, where once was the ancient temple.
That is a place of power, like to this one. I can feel the power here," he said.
He turned over and looked up into her face. "You are like the goddess of this place," he said wonderingly. "In the old worship, I know, men and women come together under her power, though the priests would like to forbid it, as they would like to tear down all the ancient stones like these above us, and the great ones of Karnak.
They have already torn down a part of them, but the task is too great.
The goddess will prevent them, said Morgaine simply.
Maybe so,
Lancelot said, and reached up to touch the blue crescent on her forehead.
It is here that you touched me when you made me see into the other world.
Has this to do with a sight, Morgaine? Or is that another of your mysteries of which you may not speak?
Well, I'll not ask you then.
But I feel as if I had been ravished into one of the old fairy forts, where, they say, 100 years can pass in a night.
Not so long as that, Morgaine said, laughing, though it is true that time runs differently there.
But some of the bards, I have heard, can still come and go from the elf country.
It's moved further than Avalon into the mists, that's all.
And as she spoke, she shivered.
Lancelot said, Maybe when I go back to the real world, the Saxons will all have been vanquished and gone.
And will you weep because there is no longer any reason for your life?
He laughed and shook his head, holding her hand in his. After a minute, he said in a low voice,
Have you, then, gone to the Beltane fires to serve the goddess?
No, said Morgaine quietly. I am virgin while the goddess wills. Most likely I am to be kept for the great marriage. Vivian hasn't made her will, or the will of the goddess, known to me.
She bent her head and let her hair fall across her face, feeling shy before him, as if he could read her thoughts and know the desire which swept through her like a sudden flame.
Would she indeed lay down that guarded virginity if he should ask it of her? Never before had the prohibition seemed a hardship. Now it seemed that a sword of fire was laid between them. There was a long silence while the shadows passed across the sun, and there was no sound except the chirping of small insects in the grass. At last, Lancelot reached up and drew her down, laying a soft kiss which burned like fire on the crescent on her brow. His voice was soft and intense.
All the gods together forbid I should trespass where the goddess has marked you for her own, my dear cousin.
I hold you sacred as the goddess herself. He held her close. She could feel that he was shaking, and a happiness so intense that it was pain flooded through her. She had never known what it was to be happy, not since she was a small and heedless child. Happiness was something she dimly remembered before her mother had burdened her with the weight of her little brother. And here, in the island, life had soared into the free spaces of the spirit, and she had known exultation and the delights of power as well as the suffering and struggle of the pain and the ordeals, but never the pure happiness she knew now. The sun seemed to burn more brightly, the clouds to move through the sky like great wings against the dazzling, sparkling air. Every bud of clover in the grass shimmered with its own interior light, a light that seemed to shine out from her as well. She saw herself mirrored in Lancelot's eyes, and knew that she was beautiful, and that he desired her, and that his love and respect for her was so great that he would even hold his own desire within bounds. She felt she would burst with her joy. Time stopped. She swam in delight. He did no more than stroke her cheek with the gentlest of feather-like caresses, and neither of them wanted more. She played softly with his fingers, feeling the calluses on his palms. After a long time he drew her against him and spread the edges of his cloak over her. They lay side by side, barely touching, letting the power of the sun and the earth and the air move through them in harmony, and she dropped into a dreamless sleep, through which she was still conscious of their intertwined hands. It seemed that some time, a very long time ago, they had lain like this, content, timeless, in an endless joyful peace, as if they were part of the standing stones which had stood here for ever, as if she both experienced and remembered being with him here. Later she woke and saw him sleeping, and sat memorizing every line of his face with a fierce tenderness. The sun had declined from noon when he woke, smiling into her eyes and stretched like a cat. Still enclosed in the bubble of her joy, she heard him say, "We were going down to hunt waterfowl. I would like to make peace with my mother. I'm so happy I cannot bear to think of being at odds with any living thing today. But perhaps the spirits of nature will send us some waterfowl whose given destiny is to make us a happy meal." She laughed, clasping his hand. "I will take you where the waterbirds hunt and fish. And if it is the will of the goddess, we will catch nothing, so we need not feel guilt about disturbing their destiny. But it is very muddy, so you must take off those boots you have for riding, and I will have to tuck up my dress again. Do you use a throwing stick like the Picts, or their little arrows with poison? Or do you snare them and wring their necks?"
"I think they suffer less when they are quickly netted and their necks broken at once," Lancelot said thoughtfully.
And she nodded.
"I will bring a net and snare."
They saw no one as they climbed down the tor, sliding in a few minutes down what had taken them more than an hour to climb. Morgaine slipped into the building where nets and snares were kept, and brought out two. They went quietly along the shore and found the reeds at the far side of the island. Barefoot, they waded into the water, hiding in the reeds and spreading the nets. They were in the great shadow of the tor, and the air felt chill. The water birds were already beginning to descend in numbers to feed. After a moment, a bird began to struggle and flap, its feet caught in Morgaine's snare. She moved swiftly, seized it, and within seconds broke its neck. Soon Lancelot caught one, then another. He tied their necks together with a band of reeds.
"That's enough," he said. "It's good sport. But on such a day as this I would rather not kill anything needlessly. And there is one for my mother, and two for the Merlin. Do you want one for yourself?"
She shook her head. "I eat no flesh," she said.
"You are so tiny," he said. "I suppose you need little food." "I am big, and I hunger quickly."
"Are you hungry now?"
"It's too early for most berries, but we might find some haws from the winter." "No," he said. "Not now, not really. My supper will be all the more welcome for a little hunger."
They came up on the shore, soaked. Morgaine pulled off her deerskin overtunic to dry it on a bush, for it would stiffen, and pulled off her skirt, too, wringing out the water, standing unself-consciously in her undershift of unbleached linen. They found where they had left their shoes, but they didn't put them on, only sitting on the grass, holding hands quietly, and watching the waterfowl swimming, suddenly upending their tails and diving for small fish.
"How still it is," Lancelot said.
"It is as if we were the only people alive in all the world today, outside time and space and all cares and troubles, or thoughts of war or battle or kingdoms or strife." She said, her voice shaking as the thought struck her that this golden time must end, "I wish this day could last for ever."
"Morgaine, are you weeping?"
he asked in sudden solicitude. "No," she said fiercely, shaking a single rebellious drop from her lashes, seeing the world burst into prism colours. She had never been able to weep, had never shed a single tear in fear or pain, through all the years of ordeals in the making of a priestess.
"Cousin, kinswoman."
"Morgaine," he said, holding her against him, stroking her cheek. She turned and clung to him, burying her face in the front of his tunic. He felt warm. She could feel the steady beat of his heart. After a moment, he bent and laid one hand under her chin, raising her face, and their lips met. He whispered,
"I would you were not pledged to the goddess."
"I too," she said softly. "Come here. Come here. Let me hold you like this.
I have sworn I will not trespass."
She closed her eyes. She no longer cared. Her oath seemed 1,000 leagues and 1,000 years distant, and not even the thought of Vivian's anger could have deterred her. Years afterward, she wondered what would have happened if they had stayed like that even a few more minutes. No doubt the goddess in whose hands they lay would have had her will with them. But even as their lips joined again, Lancelot stiffened a little, as if hearing something just outside the range of hearing. Morgain pulled away and sat up.
"Morgain, what is that?"
"I hear nothing," she said, straining to hear beyond the sound of soft water lapping in the lake, wind rustling in the reeds, and the occasional sound of a fish jumping. And then it came again, like a soft sighing, like someone weeping.
"Someone is crying," said Lancelot, and unfolded his long legs quickly to stand up. "Over there. Someone is hurt or lost. It sounds like a little girl."
Morgain followed quickly, barefoot, leaving her skirt and tunic on the bush. It was just possible that one of the younger priestesses might have become lost here, though they weren't supposed to leave the enclosure near the House of Maidens. Still, young girls were young girls, and couldn't yet be trusted not to break rules. One of the old priestesses had once said that the House of Maidens was for little girls whose whole duty in life was to spill things, break things, and forget things, the rules of their daily life among them, until they had spilled, broken, and forgotten everything they could, and thus made room in their lives for a little wisdom. And now that Morgain was a full priestess, she had begun to instruct the young. And sometimes she felt that the old priestess had been right. Surely she had never been so silly and empty-headed as the girls who were now in the House of Maidens. They followed the sound. It was hazy, now fading out for minutes altogether, and then coming back quite clear. Mist was beginning to drift in from the lake in thick tendrils, and Morgain wasn't quite sure whether it was ordinary fog born of the dampness and the approaching sunset, or whether it was the outlying mist of the veil surrounding the magical realm.
"There," said Lancelot, plunging suddenly into the mist.
Morgain followed him, and saw dimly, fading from shadow into reality and back again, the figure of a young girl standing in the water up to her ankles and crying. "Yes," Morgain realized, "she's really there, and, no, this is no priestess." She was very young and dazzlingly pretty. She seemed all white and gold, her skin pale as ivory, just stained with coral, her eyes palest sky blue, her hair long and pale and shining through the mist like living gold. She wore a white dress, which she was trying unsuccessfully to hold out of the water. And somehow she seemed to shed tears without any ugly distortion of her face, so that weeping she only looked prettier than ever.
Morgain said, "What is the matter, child? Are you lost?"
She stared at them as they came closer and whispered, "Who are you? I didn't think anyone could hear me here. I called out to the sisters, but none of them could hear me. And then the land started to move, and where it had been all solid, suddenly I was standing here in the water, and the reeds were all around me, and I was afraid. What is this place? I never saw it before, and I've been in the convent for almost a year now. And she crossed herself. Suddenly Morgaine knew what had happened. The veil had thinned, as it did occasionally in spots of such concentrated power, and somehow this girl had had enough sensitivity to be aware of it. This happened sometimes, as a momentary vision, so that someone could see the other world as a shadow or a brief vision. But to move through into the other world was rare. The girl took a step toward them, but under her feet the marshy surface swayed, and she stopped in panic. "Stand still," Morgaine said gently. "The ground is a little unsafe here. I know the paths. I'll help you out, dear." But even as she moved forward, her hand extended, Lancelot stepped in front of her, picked up the young girl, and carried her to dry land, setting her down.
"Your shoes are wet," he said, for they squelched as she moved. "Take them off and you can dry them."
She looked at him in wonder. She had stopped crying. "You're very strong. Not even my father is as strong as that. And I think I've seen you somewhere, haven't I?"
"I don't know," Lancelot said. "Who are you? Who is your father?"
"My father is King Leodegrance," she said. "But I'm here at school in the convent." Her voice began to shake again. "Where is it? I can't even see the building anywhere, or the church."
"Don't cry," Morgaine said, stepping forward,
and the young girl drew back a little. "Are you one of the fairy folk? You have that blue sign on your forehead." And she raised her hand and crossed herself again. "No," she said doubtfully. "You cannot be a demoness. You don't vanish when I cross myself, as the sisters say any demon must do. But you are little and ugly, like the fairy people."
Lancelot said firmly, "No, of course, neither of us is a demon, and I think we can find the way back to your convent for you."
Morgaine, her heart sinking, saw that he now looked upon the stranger as he had looked on her only minutes before, with love, desire, almost worship. As he turned back to Morgaine, saying eagerly, "We can help her, can't we?" Morgaine saw herself as she must look to Lancelot and to the strange golden maiden, small, dark, with a barbarian blue sign on her forehead, her shift muddy to the knees, her arms immodestly bare, and her feet filthy, her hair coming down. "Little and ugly, like one of the fairy folk. Morgaine of the fairies." So they had taunted her since childhood. She felt a surge of self-hatred, of loathing for her small, dark body, her half-naked limbs, the muddy deerskin. She snatched her damp skirt off the bush and put it on, conscious suddenly of her bare limbs. She wound the filthy deerskin tunic over it. For a moment, as Lancelot looked at her, she felt that he too must think her ugly, barbarian, alien. This exquisite golden creature belonged to his own world. He came and gently took the stranger girl's hand with a respectful bow.
"Come, we can show you the way back."
"Yes," said Morgaine dully. "I will show you the way. Follow me, and stay close, because the ground is treacherous, and you could mire yourself and not get out for a long time." For a furious moment she was tempted to lead them both into the impassable mire. She could do it. She knew the way. Lead them out there and leave them to drown, or wander for ever in the mists. Lancelot asked, "What is your name?" The fair girl said, "My name is Guinevere." And she heard Lancelot murmuring, "What a lovely name, fitting to the lady who bears it." Morgaine felt a surge of hatred so great she thought that she would faint with its force. She felt it would be with her until she died, and in that molten instant she actually longed for death. All the colour had gone from the day, into the mist and the mire and the dismal reeds, and all her happiness had gone with it. "Come," she repeated in a leaden voice, "and I will show you the way." As she turned to go, she heard them laughing together behind her, and wondered, through the dull surge of hatred, if they were laughing at her. She heard Guinevere's girlish voice saying, "But you don't belong to this horrible place, do you? You don't look like one of the fairy folk. You're not little and ugly." No, she thought, no, he was beautiful and she little and ugly. The words burned into her heart. She forgot that she looked like Vivian, and that to her, Vivian was beautiful. She heard Lancelot saying, "No, no, I would love to come back with you. Really, I would. But I'm promised to dine with a relative this night, and my mother is angry enough with me already. I don't want to make the old gentleman angry, too. But no, I don't belong to Avalon." And, after a minute, "No, she's, well, a cousin of my mother's, or something like that. We knew each other when we were children, that's all." And now she knew that he was speaking of her. So quickly, then, all that had been between them had been reduced to a distant family tie. Fiercely fighting back a surge of tears that made her throat ache, knowing that weeping would make her uglier than ever in their eyes, she stepped on dry land. "There lies your convent, Guinevere. Be careful to keep to the path, or you may lose yourself in the mists again." She saw that the girl had been holding Lancelot's hand. It seemed to Morgaine that he let it go reluctantly. The girl said, "Thank you. Oh, thank you."
"It is Morgaine you should thank," Lancelot reminded her. "It is she who knows the paths in and out of Avalon."
The girl gave her a shy, sidelong look. She dropped a little polite curtsy. "I thank you, Mistress Morgaine." Morgaine drew a deep breath, drawing the mantle of a priestess around her again. The glamour she could summon when she would, despite her filthy and torn clothing, her bare feet, the hair that straggled in wet locks around her shoulders, she knew that suddenly she looked tall and imposing. She made a remote gesture of blessing, and turned, silent, summoning Lancelot with another gesture. She knew, even though she didn't see, that the awe and fright had returned to the girl's eyes. But she moved silently away with the noiseless gliding of a priestess of Avalon. Lancelot's steps, reluctant, following her own silent ones. After a moment she looked back, but the mists had closed, and the girl had vanished within them. Lancelot said, shaken, "How did you do that, Morgaine?"
"How did I do what?" she asked.
"Suddenly look so like my mother, all tall and distant and remote, and not quite real, like a female demon. You frightened the poor girl. You shouldn't have done it."
Morgaine bit her tongue with her sudden wrath. She said in a remote and enigmatic voice, "Cousin, I am what I am," and turned, hurrying up the path ahead of him. She was cold and weary and sick with an inner sickness. She longed for the solitude of the House of Maidens. Lancelot seemed a long way behind her, but she no longer cared. He could find his own way from here. Chapter 13. In the spring of the year after this, through a drenching late winter storm, the Merlin came late one night to Avalon. When word was brought to the lady, she stared in astonishment.
"A night such as this would drown the very frogs," she said. "What brings him out in such weather?"
"I do not know, lady," said the young apprentice druid who had brought the word. "He didn't even send for the barge,
but made his own way by the hidden paths, and said that he must see you this night before you slept. I sent him for dry clothing. His own was in such a state as you can imagine. I would have brought him food and wine as well, but he asked if he might sup with you.
"Tell him he is welcome," Vivian said, keeping her face carefully neutral. She had learned very well the art of concealing her thoughts, but when the young man had gone, she allowed herself to stare in amazement and to frown. She sent for her attendant women, and bade them bring not her usual spare supper, but food and wine for the Merlin, and to build up the fire anew. After a time she heard his step outside, and when he came in he went directly to the fire. Taliesin was stooped now, his hair and beard all white, and he looked somewhat incongruous in the green robe of a novice bard, far too short for him, so that his scrawny ankles protruded from the lower edge of the garment. She seated him near the fire. He was still, she noticed, shivering, and set a plate of food and a cup of wine, good apple wine from Avalon itself, in a chased silver cup at his side. Then she seated herself on a small stool nearby, and tasted her bread and dried fruit as she watched him eat. When he had pushed the plate aside and sat sipping at the wine, she said, "Now, tell me everything, father." The old man smiled at her.
"I never thought to hear you call me so, Vivian. Or do you think I've taken the holy orders of the church in my dotage?"
She shook her head.
"No," she said, "but you were the lover of my mother, who was lady here before me, and you fathered two of my sisters. Together we have served the goddess and Avalon for more years than I can number. And perhaps I long for the comfort of a father's voice this night. I don't know. I feel very old this night. Far Taliesin, is it that you think me too old to be your daughter?"
The old druid smiled.
"Never that, Vivian. You are ageless. I know how old you are, or I could reckon up your age if I chose. But still you seem a girl to me. You might even now have as many lovers as you chose, if you willed it."
She dismissed that with a gesture.
"Be sure I have never found any man who meant more to me than necessity, or duty, or a knight's pleasure," she said. "And only once, I think, any man save yourself who came near to matching me in strength."
She laughed.
"Though, had I been 10 years younger, how, think you, would I have befitted the throne as the High King's queen, and my son the throne? I do not think Galahad, what is it he would have you call him now, Lancelot? I don't think he is the stuff of which kings are made. He is a visionary, a reed shaken by the wind. But if he'd been fathered by Uther Pendragon..."
Taliesin shook his head.
"He is a follower, Vivian, not a leader."
"Even so. That comes from being reared at Ban's court as a bastard. Had he been reared as a king's son..."
"And who would have ruled Avalon in those years had you chosen a crown in the Christian lands outside?"
"If I had ruled them at Uther's side," she said, "they would not have been Christian lands. I thought Ygraine would have power over him and use it for Avalon."
He shook his head.
"There is no use in fretting after last winter's snow, Vivian. It is of Uther I came to speak. He is dying."
She raised her head and stared at him.
"So, it has come already."
She felt her heart racing.
"He is too young to die."
"He leads his men into battle where a wiser man of his years might leave it to his generals. He took a wound, and fever set in. I offered my services as healer, but Ygraine forbade it, as did the priests,
I could have done nothing anyway. His time has come. I saw it in his eyes.
How does Igraine as queen?
Very much as you would have foreseen, said the old druid. She is beautiful and dignified and pious, and goes always in mourning for the children she has lost. She bore another son at All Hallows. He lived 4 days, no more. And her house priest has convinced her it is the punishment for her sins. No breath of scandal has ever touched her since she married Uther, save for the birth of that first child so soon. But that was enough. I asked her what would become of her after Uther's death. And when she had done weeping for that, she said she would retire into a convent. I offered her the shelter of Avalon, where she could be near to her daughter. But she said it wouldn't be seemly for a Christian queen.
Vivian's smile hardened a little. I never thought to hear that of Igraine.
Vivian, you mustn't blame her, even in thought, for what you yourself have wrought. Avalon cast her out when most she needed it. Would you chide the girl because she has found comfort in a simpler faith than ours?
I doubt it not. You are the only man in all of Britain who could speak of the High Queen as a girl.
To me, Vivian, even you are a little girl at times. That same little girl who used to climb on my knee and touch the strings of my harp.
And now I can hardly play. My fingers lose their suppleness with the years, Vivian said.
He shook his head.
Ah, no, my dear,
he said, holding out his own thin, gnarled old fingers.
Next to this, your hands are young. Yet daily I speak to my harp with them, and you could have done so as well. Your hands chose to wield power, not song.
And what would have become of Britain if I had not? She flared at him.
Vivian,
he said, with a touch of sternness.
I did not censure you. I merely spoke the thing which is.
She sighed and leaned her chin in her hands.
I spoke well when I said that this night I was in need of a father.
So it has come upon us already, the thing we feared and have wrought for all these years.
What of Uther's son, my father? Is he ready?
He must be ready, said the Merlin. Uther will not live till Midsummer Day, and already the carrion crows gather, as they did when Ambrosius lay dying. As for the boy, have you not seen him?
Now and again I see a glimpse of him in the magic mirror, she said. He looks healthy and strong, but that tells me nothing except that he can look the part of a king when it comes to that.
You have visited him, have you not? At Uther's will. I went now and again to see how he grew. I saw that he had those same books in Latin and Greek which taught your son so much of strategy and warfare. Hectorius is Roman to the core, and the conquests of Caesar and the exploits of Alexander are part of his very being. He is an educated man, and has trained both his sons for warfare. Young Caius was blooded in battle last year. Arthur fretted that he couldn't go. But he is an obedient son to Hectorius, and did as he was told.
If he is so much Roman, Vivian asked, will Arthur be willing to be subject to Avalon? For he must rule the tribes as well, and the Pictish folk, remember.
I saw to that, said the Merlin, for I induced him to meet some of the little people, saying that they were the allies of Uther's soldiers in this war to defend our island. With them he has learned to shoot their elf bolts, and to move silently in the heather and over the moors, and...
He hesitated and said significantly,
He can stalk the deer, and does not fear to go among them.
Vivian closed her eyes for a moment. He is so young.
The goddess chooses always the youngest and strongest of men to lead her warriors, said Taliesin.
Vivian bowed her head.
"Be it so," she said. "He shall be tested. Bring him here, if you can, before Uther dies."
"Here?"
The Merlin shook his head.
"Not till the testing is done. Only then can we show him the road to Avalon and the two realms over which he must rule."
Again Vivian bowed her head.
"To Dragon Island, then?"
"It will be the ancient challenge. Uther was not tested so at his king-making."
"Uther was a warrior. It was enough to make him lord over the dragon," Vivian said. "This boy is young and unblooded. He must be tested and proven."
"And if he fails?"
Vivian gritted her teeth.
"He mustn't fail."
Taliesin waited until she met his eyes again and repeated,
"And if he fails?"
She sighed.
"No doubt Lot is ready, if that should come."
"You should have taken one of Morgause's sons and fostered him here at Avalon,"
the Merlin said.
"Gawain is a likely boy, hot-headed, quarrelsome, a bull where Uther's boy is a stag. But there is the stuff of a king in Gawain, I think. And he also is goddess-born. Morgause, too, was your mother's daughter, and her sons have the royal blood."
"I don't trust Lot," said the lady vehemently.
"And I trust Morgause less than that. Yet Lot holds a clansman to the north, and I think the tribes would accept him."
"But those who hold to Rome, never," said the lady.
"And then there would be two kingdoms in Britain ever warring, and neither strong enough to hold off the Saxons and the wild Northmen. No, Uther's son it must be. He must not fail." "That must be as the goddess wills," said the Merlin sternly. "See you mistake not your own will for hers."
Vivian covered her face with her hands.
If he fails, it would all have been for nothing," she said wildly. "All that I have done to Igraine, all I have done to all those I love." "Father, have you foreseen that it would fail?"
The old man shook his white head, and his voice was compassionate.
"The goddess does not make her will known to me," he said. "And it was you who foresaw that this boy would have the powers to lead all of Britain. I caution you against pride, Vivian, thinking you know the best for every man and woman living. You have ruled well in Avalon."
"But I am old," she said,
raising her face, and she could see the pity in his eyes.
"And one day soon..."
The Merlin bowed his head. He too lived under that law.
"When that time comes, you will know."
"It is not yet, Vivian."
"No," she said, struggling against the sudden despair which had come, as it sometimes did now, a heat in her body, a torment in her mind.
"When it comes, when I can no longer see what lies ahead, then I will know it is time to give over the rulership of Avalon to another. Morgaine is still young, and Raven, whom I love well, has given herself to silence and the voice of the goddess. It has not yet come, but if it comes too soon..."
"Whenever it comes, Vivian, that will be the right time,"
the Merlin said. He stood up, tall and unsteady, and Vivian saw that he leaned heavily on his stick.
"I will bring the boy to Dragon Island, then, at the spring thaw, and we will see whether he is ready to be made king. And then you will give him the sword and the cup, in token that there is an eternal link between Avalon and the world outside."
"The sword, at least," Vivian said.
"The cup?
I do not know." The Merlin bowed his head.
"That I leave to your wisdom. You, not I, are the voice of the goddess. Yet you will not be the goddess for him."
Vivian shook her head.
"He will meet the mother when he is triumphant," she said, "and from her hand he will take the sword of victory. But first he must prove his own, and must meet first with the maiden huntress."
A flicker of a smile crossed her face.
"And no matter what happens after that," she said, "we will take no such chance as we did with Uther and Ygraine. We shall make certain of the royal blood, whatever comes of it later."
When the Merlin had gone away, she sat for a long time watching pictures in the fire, seeing into the past alone, not seeking to look through the mist of time toward the future. She too, years ago, so many years that she couldn't now remember how many, had laid down her maidenhood to the horned god, the great hunter, the lord of the living spiral dance. She hardly spared a thought for the virgin who would take this part in the king-making which was to come. But she let her mind stray into the past, and the other time she had played the part of the goddess in the great marriage. Never had it been more to her than duty, sometimes pleasant, sometimes distasteful, but always bidden, possessed by the great mother who had ruled her life since first she had come here. Suddenly she envied Ygraine, and a detached part of her mind wondered why she envied a woman who had lost all her children to death or fosterage, and now was to suffer widowhood and end her life behind convent walls. "What I envy her is the love she has known. I have no daughters. My sons are strangers and alien to me. I have never loved," she thought. "Nor have I known what it is to be loved. Fear, awe, reverence, these have been given me. Never love. And there are times when I think I would give it all for one look from any human being such as Uther gave Ygraine at their wedding." She sighed bleakly, repeating half aloud what the Merlin had said. "Well, there is no use fretting after last year's snowfall." She raised her head, and her attendant came on noiseless feet.
"Lady, bring me..."
"No," she said, changing her mind abruptly. "Let the girl sleep. It is not true that I have never loved or been loved. I love Morgaine beyond all measuring, and she loves me."
Now that, too, might come to an end, but that, too, must be as the goddess willed it. Chapter 14. The palest splinter of new moon stood to the west of Avalon. Morgaine paced slowly upward, her bare feet treading out the spiral pathway, noiseless and pale as the virgin moon. Her hair was unbound, her single garment uncinctured. She knew that guards and priestesses watched her, silent, lest some unauthorized person disturb her silence with an unconsecrated word. Behind the dark curtain of her hair, her eyelids were lowered. She moved unerringly on the path, without need for sight. Raven moved silently behind her, like Morgaine, barefoot, ungirdled, her unbound hair curtaining her face. Upward and upward in the darkening twilight, with a few stars pale in the indigo dome above them. The ringstones were grey and shadowy, a single pallid flicker within them. Not fire. Some will-o'-the-wisp, witch-fire, sorcery, gleaming out from within the magic circle. By the last flicker of the setting moon, reflected for a moment in the shining lake below, a silent maiden priestess moved toward them. Only a little girl, robed in undyed wool, her shorn hair no more than a wisp of darkness. She offered Morgaine a cup, and Morgaine accepted it, and drank in silence, then handed the cup to Raven, who drained its last drops. Silver and gold gleamed in the dying light. Morgaine took, from unseen hands, the great cross-handled sword, gasping a little at the unexpected weight. Barefoot, cold, but not aware of it, she traced out the circle under the ringstones. Behind her, Raven took up the long spear, thrust it into the heart of the witchfire. Light sprang up on the bit of tow there, and she carried it, after Morgaine, all around the circle, a dim line of pale witchfire springing up around the dimness. Returning to the centre by the dimmest of pale lights, they saw the face of Vivian, ageless, timeless, floating in mid-air, disembodied, the face of the goddess, shining. Although Morgaine knew that the effect was produced by a luminous substance smeared on cheeks and brow against the darkness of the circle and the dark garments, it never failed to make her catch her breath. Bodiless, shining hands laid something in Morgaine's hands, then in Raven's. Morgaine bit into the sharp wooden bitterness, forced herself past sickness to swallow. Silence descended. Eyes gleamed in the dark, but no faces could be seen. She felt as if she were standing among multitudes beyond multitudes, thronging the top of the tor, but she could see no single face among them. Even Vivian's bodiless face had vanished into the dark. She could feel the warmth of Raven's body near hers, though they nowhere touched one another. She tried to keep her mind still in meditation, moving into the schooled silence, not sure why she had been brought here. Time passed. Stars brightened against the ever-darkening sky. Time, Morgaine thought. Time runs differently in Avalon, or perhaps it doesn't exist. Many nights during the long years she had traced out the spiral paths up the tor, probing the mysteries of time and space within the circle of the ringstones. Yet tonight seemed stranger, darker, somehow more weighted with mystery. Never before had she been called out from the other priestesses to play the major part in ritual. She knew that what she had been given, the magical feast, was an herb used to strengthen the sight, that did not diminish its power or its magic. After a time, in the darkness, she began to see pictures in her mind, small coloured pictures, as if at a very great distance. She saw a herd of deer running. She saw again the great darkness that had descended upon the land when the sun went out and a cold wind blew, and she had been afraid that the world was ending. But the older priestesses had explained to her, as they gathered in the courtyard, that the moon god was effacing the brightness of the goddess, and she ran out with them joyously to join in the shrieks of the women to frighten him away. Later it had been explained to her how the sun and moon moved, and why, now and again, one of them crossed the face of the other, that it was in the way of nature, and the common people's beliefs about the face of the gods were symbols which these people, at the current state of their evolution, needed to visualize the great truths. Some day all men and women would know the inner truths, but now they needed them not. She watched in the inner sight, as she had done in life, while again and again the cycles of the year swung around the great ringstones. She watched the birth and fecundity, and at last the dying of the god. She saw the great processions winding up the spiral toward the oak grove before the ringstones had been set here. Time was transparent. It ceased to have meaning as the little painted people came and ripened and were cut down. And then the tribes, and after them the Romans in their turn, and tall strangers from the coast of Gaul. And after them? Time ceased, and she only saw the movement of peoples and the overgrowth of the world. Ice came and receded, and came again. She saw the great temples of Atlantis, now drowned forever between the covering oceans, saw new worlds rising and setting. And silence. And beyond the night the great stars wheeled and swung. Behind her she heard an eerie wailing cry, and her skin